It's weird. We may have sold less records in Charlotte than anywhere else. You know? We sold lots of records in California. We sold lots of records in New York.
Wow.
Recorded lots of records in Japan. But in Charlotte, it was like they did not know quite what to think of us. They thought we were cute, and they liked hearing us and all that. But the original songs were Time to Go Get a Beer songs, I think.
I'm Joni Deutsch, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Amplifier, the music podcast where we shine a light on the Charlotte music scene. Because Charlotte is more than just a banking city or a football city. So each weekday during the month of September, we're going to explore the people, places, and things that help define the Queen City's crown sound. And today, a leader of one of the most popular power pop groups of the 80s, the Spongetones, whose work has influenced generations of musicians. That's coming up on Amplifier.
Amplifier. And then the beat will drop.
Amplifier.
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 Can you introduce yourself and what you do with music?
Yeah, my name is Jamie Hoover. I'm a musician, I guess mainly a guitar player, although I play bass. I can play, kind of get around on the four food groups, bass, drums, a little bit of keyboards, vocals. And I produce records. I had a recording studio of some shape or form in my life for the last 40 years, something like that. And that's what I do. I either play gigs or make recordings of people. I also teach recording at the community college in Southport, North Carolina, which is where I live.
Jamie, I have heard so much about you and your work in bands, which we're going to get into in just a bit. But I knew that you were someone I just needed to reach out to you for this podcast, this music interview series, because so many folks cited your work as why they're so happy to be part of Charlotte Music, whether that is you helping them record music or if they opened for you and your band at gigs, or simply that they were raised on your music as a fan. It sounds like your ties to music just go all over the place, and I can't wait to dive into as many of them as possible as we can during this interview.
Yeah, it's an honor. Thank you very much.
So we'll go ahead and get started with how you got started in music. Can you take us back to the first time that you felt like this could be something to dive into as a career or a life?
The first things I remember hearing were just on the radio, and it was in the 60s. I was a little boy, and everything was magical that came off the radio. I remember in particular Sukiyaki, that song, Sukiyaki, was like one of the first sort of magic things for me. But really revolves around the Beatles for me. My sister was a big fan of the Beatles and had those 45s, and I fell in love with the music, and I remember seeing them on Ed Sullivan, and I just said, this is what I have to do. This is my mission.
Oh, yeah, I tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand.
That was really the beginning of the whole thing for me. I spent the rest of my life trying to get to that position. But I don't know, the Beatles were just absolutely the whole package, you know, of what they did. In fact, being British, too. I wanted to be British.
What do you mean? I can hear the accent in your voice. You're clearly British.
Yeah, I am. It's funny, with the Spongetones, it's always like these four guys from the South who make records, and they sound like they're British, you know, when they sing. But it's just osmosis, I guess, you know. That's all any of us listen to. That was what we were into. And you just absorb it, you know, which is, I guess, you know, makes sense with the name Spongetones. That was actually not intentional either. That was the name Sponge Notes was really just kind of they wanted the goofiest sounding thing that they could have with the name Tones on the end of it, because everybody was the something Tones back then. So, but it turned out to fit, didn't it?
It sounds like it. All these years later.
Yeah.
I wonder, back when you were first listening to music like the Beatles, and you're thinking, I want to be them one day. Were there other artists or bands where you lived, which I assume is North Carolina and Charlotte, were there other bands near you regionally that you felt the same about?
There were some really good bands. You know, when the Beatles first came out, I mean, they were from Mars, you know, and the Beatles and the Kinks and the Descartes Five, all those guys, they were really from Mars at that point. But even in Charlotte, you know, there were bands that came around. There was a band called the Hodads that was great. There was a band called the Paragons. Actually, our guitar player, Pat, in the Sponge Tones was in the Paragons, that were really great. But there were a whole lot of good bands in Charlotte. It's really, you know, it was a fairly decent-sized city, I guess, even then. And there was a great recording studio, Arthur Smith Studio, was there, where Papa's Got a Brand New Bag was recorded, you know. So I guess it was just kind of waiting to happen.
Tell me about the first time that you were a part of a band.
My very first band was called The Surfers, and we were a pantomime, you know, so we put on Monkees Records and just, you know, pantomime to it. We did that at school, and that was fun, and the girls still thought we were cool, you know. Everybody sort of had turtleneck sweaters.
If only they knew.
Oh, I know. Well, they knew, you know. We had matching turtleneck sweaters and all the stuff. The Monkees had plaid pants and wide belts, you know. Hip huggers, all that sort of stuff. So we looked good, and but I guess my first band was called a band called the Ones Before, and it was just me and a friend that I went to school with, and a drummer that he knew, and we played what we could. We figured out the songs that we were able to put together at that level musically. Any of those songs with three chords that you could just fearlessly pound through, you know, because it was all about looking confident anyway, even if you weren't confident. It was just about looking confident.
Well, I think that's maybe one of the reasons why those British Invasion bands were so great, because when they got up on stage, you could just see how organized they were and coordinated and effortlessly cool. And I'm sure that's just one of the many appeals to that kind of music, is you didn't just want to listen to them, you wanted to be them.
Yeah, I totally wanted to be them. Now, the early Merseybeat bands, I mean, they did a whole lot of homework. I mean, the Beatles did all that, you know, Hamburg work, all the playing all over the place, and they had a lot of time to work that stuff out. And there were so many people doing that, so we're just really feeding off of that scene, the Liverpool stuff, anything they were doing in England.
So you were in these bands, I guess, in the late, mid-60s. What happened over the course of that decade up until the point where the Sponge Tones, the band that everyone would talk about with your name, that came about?
Around 17, I was able to get my father to buy me a Tiak 3340 tape recorder, which was a four-track reel-to-reel machine. And that was like, you know, unbelievable at the time. And, you know, I really didn't plan on going to college. I just wanted to make music. That's all I cared about. So the best thing my father could do was get me that recorder. You know, I started making recordings early, and then I was lucky enough to get a job at a one-inch eight-track recording studio up the street from where I lived off of South Boulevard in Charlotte, right at Greystone Road, where I live. So I learned a whole lot about miking and just dealing with, you know, the professional part of it then. And the Sponge Tones were playing around. They had another guitar player before me. Actually had two different people that played before me, but they didn't do many gigs. And one of them, Keith Brooks, was leaving. And I had done a session with this guy, Alan Kaufman, at that eight-track studio. He said, let's go see the Sponge Tones. They're playing at the Double Door. So we went over there, and Pat said, hey, Keith's leaving the band, and you're in. That was pretty much it. And it was like, you have just made my dreams come true, because I wanted to be in that band. I went to see him a couple times, and they were like, It was like seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. This is what I want to do. This is all I care about doing. I want to be in this band. So, and my life got better immediately.
How long had the Sponge Tones been playing in Charlotte by the time that you were asked to join the group?
I think they did 3 or 4 gigs before me, something like that. It was late 79 when I played with them at the Double Door for the first time.
So they were still new. This wasn't like they had been performing for a decade or
so. No, they
were
just
through lineups.
Yeah, no, they were just the guys were good. The guys were good enough to just throw it together, you know, for one thing. And then they hadn't done a whole lot of work at first. I consider myself an original band member because we hadn't done any recording or anything until I got into the band, which actually I talked them into doing that. I said, let's write some things in that style and make a recording of it. But when I got in the band, I said, let's play as much as possible. Let's, you know. And we really quickly started drawing, like, lots of people. You know, it was a good band, you know, from the get-go. Plus, it was also before retro radio, so you couldn't really hear the Kinks on the radio. Like, it's not hard to hear that now, especially with satellite, you know. You can hear anything you want. But then it was like, you know, that stuff was forgotten, you know, old square music, you know. So we were, like, bringing that back. And but I was 22, 23 when the first Bunch on started. So we were young and pretty, and we were delivering it, you know, very seriously. So we made fans. We had lots of girls that that wanted to be our girlfriends. They would drive back and forth and, you know, like go to a shopping mall or something like that. They'd start following you, you know. It was very cool. We were very, very, you know, sort of famous in Charlotte.
I want to bring that up because in the 80s, you were part of one of the most popular power pop groups. Obviously, that was the Sponge Tones. And for those who haven't been introduced to the band's work, how would you describe the band's sound?
We were trying to write songs that would have been popular in 63 or 64. So that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to make a record that if you played it next to an old Kinks record would sound like it was made back then.
I mean, looking back to reviews of your first couple of records, like just a quote from Billboard magazine in 1983 where they said, quote, "The Sponge Tones bring a heartfelt appreciation to the genre that is positively entertaining." I mean, it sounds like it didn't come across as a doppelganger. It came across as sincere and authentic, even if it was inspired by the actual Brits, not by folks that currently live in a southern zip code.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, every band, nobody comes out of the gate saying, "I was born God." You know, everybody, at least that they're being honest, has people that they like, that they listened to before. And, you know, what you try to do first is see if I can make something that sounds like that, that's mine. And so we were real genuine about it. We weren't trying to pull anything over. We just wanted to be viewed as a band that, you know, came along, 15 years later or whatever. It became so fun writing stuff like that. It's like, here's another, you know. We just kind of threw ourselves into it, and we eventually had an LP's worth of stuff.
She's everything I want a girl to be. I thought that I was happy as could be. But then I heard from you. You said you love me too. I'm in between. You said
we did a lot of demos for it that actually were released later on as Beat the Sponge Stones, like Meet the Beatles, you know, Beat the Sponge Stones. Beat, meaning it was beat music. That's why we called the first album Beat Music. It was weird because, you know, from the area, it was a beach music was the big deal, and it was so close to that, beat music. But that was totally authentic. That was the right thing to call it.
Yeah, and that was from 1982, their first LP as a band recording. And Rolling Stone actually praised it as being the soundtrack to a party so good it could never happen in real life.
Yeah. Now, that was such vindication. I mean, it was like when the record was out kind of for a year before that Rolling Stone review happened, or it was out for a good bit, you know, and the local critics did not know what to make of it. They were like kind of embarrassed. You know, what are these guys doing? They're
really
a cover band, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we got an article in the paper, and they just did not get it. And until Rolling Stone got it, and then it was like, well, we knew it all the time, you know. They were, some, but, you know, it was weird, but it was very exciting when that first Rolling Stone thing came out. And we were on, like, the Rolling Stone hotline where you could call up they had a phone number, you could call it up, and they were playing Where Were You Last Night? It was exciting. It looked like it was starting to happen.
Where were you last night?
Coming up, Jamie Hoover on making it and breaking it in the music business and the life lessons learned along the way. That's right after this break on Amplifier. Hey, Amplifier friends. Time flies when you're discovering great music, right? Well, we've received a number of questions from listeners like you about the future of this podcast. Will Amplifier continue past September? And will we continue highlighting the Charlotte music scene as a podcast? To which I say, yes and yes. Right now, Amplifier is a daily podcast for September, and it will continue as a bi-weekly podcast starting in October, with new episodes every other week. We have so many musical roads left to explore in Charlotte, and we want you along for the ride. So do not miss a beat. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you find podcasts. You can find out where and how to subscribe to Amplifier on WFAE.org/Amplifier. And thank you for the support. As you're subscribing to the podcast in your favorite app, let's get back to our interview. Over the course of the Sponge Tones musical life, you know, you performed at the legendary CBGB in the mid-80s. And I mean, even towards the end of the Sponge Tones career, in 2009, you were in Tokyo touring for a little bit. So what were your goals, or what were the band's goals in making music? Was there just some list of things that, as the Sponge Tones, y'all really wanted to happen?
You know, we were hoping to get signed to a major label in the U.S. That never happened in the U.S. It did happen in Japan, so we were lucky enough to get that. We did get a good independent label, Repeat, to put those records out, those first couple of records out. And they helped us a lot. They sent off to college radio, and college radio at that point was the way to go anyway. You know, that was the direction that we needed to be pursuing, and they did that. So that was good for us. You know, we got records on American Bandstand. Our drummer Rob did a lot of work to get those things happening. We of course wanted to make a living from it, and we did for a number of years. So no regrets. I'm glad we did everything we did.
That was going to be my next question, actually. I mean, were there any regrets for the Sponge Tones not making it bigger nationally?
Well, it was funny because all the labels looked at us, but they would say, they sound too much like the Beatles, you know. So they didn't get it. And, you know, we were doing it right, but they didn't get it. And I was disappointed in them, not in us, you know, there. My biggest regret is that when we were young enough that we didn't leave Charlotte, you know, not leave, move, but leave to do a lot of touring. In other words, if we stayed around town, we'd make a bunch of money. We were stars, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, if we hit the road, we would have been sleeping all in one motel room. And, you know, when we did hit the road, and we did hit the road a lot, but we played frat parties and we played covers. And that was a mistake. I mean, everybody had kids, so it's hard to say what we could have done better. But I wish we would have been a little poorer, but traveling a little bit more, like REM did that. I mean, they went out and played every all original little dive that they could anywhere, and they ended up, you know, they had a pretty good run at it, so to speak, to quote Arthur Smith. I wish we would have done that, but you can't go back. You know, we did the best we could, and really no regrets.
Funny, I spoke with Hope Nichols about her work with Fetch and Bones, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that her story was an exact mirror of your experience being in Charlotte in the 80s making music, but there was a kind of thread there of how you had the right music and you knew that personally, but there were those in the national, bigger music industry at the time that weren't exactly prepared for that, and yeah. How that's not really your fault. You did the best
right.
You could in creating music, and you had fans
yeah.
along the way. It's
yeah.
just that it wasn't, the times weren't with you yet.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great way to put it, and I remember that with those guys too, and they still have a career and fan base now just like us, and they made great records. You know, sometimes you miss your window. I don't know what we could have done better other than maybe hit the road early, especially while we had a lot of college airplay on that first record, first and second record. Even the third record that we did on our own label got a recommended in Rolling Stone, you know. We did the best we could without a label. If we'd had a major label, I think it would have made a big difference.
I want to talk about your comment earlier about Charlotte and how
mm-hmm.
at the time you were making music, you know, you thought it was great. Rolling Stone and some national media outlets thought it was great. But Charlotte was a little, still kind of iffy about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to go back to then in like the, you know, 80s, I guess. and what the Charlotte music scene was. Back then, did you feel like it was supportive of bands like yourself?
Well, it's weird because, you know, we were, I guess you could look at us, the Sponge Stones, as an alternative band. But alternative people, the people that went to the Milestone Club and different, you know, other clubs. So we had a lot of alternative clubs, really, at the time. The first one, to my memory, being the Milestone Club, which, by the way, used to be Hoover's Hardware. My father and his brothers had a hardware store in there.
Aww.
Same building, yeah. But, you know, it was like the rock attitude thing. They wouldn't really let us be a part of the alternative scene in Charlotte. And, you know, we were mainstream. We couldn't get, you know, the hipsters, so to speak, after a while were like nose up to us, you know. It's weird, but we may have sold less records in Charlotte than anywhere else. You know? We sold lots of records in California. We sold lots of records in New York.
Wow.
Recorded lots of records in Japan and all that sort of stuff. But in Charlotte, it was like they did not know quite what to think of us. They thought we were cute and they liked hearing us and all that. But, you know, the original songs were Time to Go Get a Beer songs, I think, for them.
And as someone who is now based not in Charlotte, but still continuing with music, producing, recording, and instructing young musicians or musicians of any age, what's the one bit of advice that you give them based off your own experiences traveling, touring, making music with the Sponge Stones?
To follow their heart, not to do it for money. If you're doing it for money, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. Not to say you can't make money and be smart. You need to be smart about how you manage your money and all that. But you got to do it for your heart. You know, I would have done that first Sponge Stone record and did do that record, in fact, for free. I've made money off of it since then, but I originally did it. I would have done it, you know, I would have almost paid to do it. You know what I mean? It's like a friend of mine said to me, he said, "You're in a band that is so good, people would pay to be in that band." And he's right, you know. So I'm lucky to have that situation. And anybody that has a good situation, you know, go for it and follow your heart. Do the things. If don't do what you think somebody else wants to hear. You know, do what you want to hear and do it as best you can. The things that I've done like that have always turned out to be the best things I've ever done.
Jamie Hoover continues to produce, record, and perform music. You can find his work on jamiehoover.net. And you can find the Sponge Stones wherever fine music is streamed and sold. Amplifier is a production of WFAE. This episode was written and produced by me, Joni Deutsch. Our associate producer is Cole Del Charco. Our editors are Greg Collard and Jadon Marshall. Our theme music is provided by Dirty Art Club. Share your favorite Charlotte music recommendations on social media. Just follow and tag me. I'm at A Change of Tune. Amplifier's daily episode run is over, but we'll be back with new episodes every other week starting in October. So make sure to subscribe to the Amplifier podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and wherever you find podcasts. For more Charlotte music chats, including playlists and even a Charlotte music map, visit wfae.org/amplifier. Until next time, I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.